I'm speaking with Tim Johnson, author of the new book, Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World but Lost the Battle with China. Between 2003 and 2009, Tim Johnson was the Beijing bureau chief for Knight Ridder and McClatchy, with responsibility for China and Taiwan. He previously worked for 14 years for the Miami Herald, covering U.S. policy towards Latin America. He served as a foreign correspondent for the Herald through most of the 1990s in Central America and the Andean region, and he's currently the Mexico City bureau chief for the McClatchy newspapers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tim Johnson.
Thank you very much.
And it's interesting to think of this explosion of democracy and protest that's sweeping through the Middle East, the very region where we somehow kind of almost had a kind of racist belief that somehow the Arabs were genetically incapable of dealing with a democracy. But clearly, a lot of the sort of nonviolent strategies which are inherent in Buddhism and perhaps explain why the Chinese conquered them so easily are there. So I guess your book shines a spotlight on the fact that, you know, for all of the history that we're celebrating now, we should remember the Tiananmen example, which is the antithesis of what is happening now, right?
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting to look at this, look through the prism of Tibet at what's happening in the Middle East, because Tibetan exiles are very excited about it. They look at it with great emotion and wishful thinking, as it were, because as much as they would like to see it happen, they also sadly recognize that it's very unlikely, given the history of Tiananmen, given the history of previous cycles of unrest in Tibet, the most recent being in March of 2008. We can go into some detail about that, because the repercussions of that unrest were huge.
Well, what was interesting about the 2008 protests, and they accompanied the Olympic Games and the build-up to the Olympic Games, and the torch, of course, as it traveled around the world, was met by a lot of pro-Tibet protests. What I found interesting about that was all of the Chinese students here in the United States who were on television in kind of counter-protests, and the passion and anger and the indignation that they felt towards the Tibetans. How dare they be this ungrateful? So it seems to me that the Chinese communist leaders have done an incredibly good job of re-indoctrinating the young Chinese away from the aspirations of Tiananmen into a kind of proud sort of and somewhat aggressive nationalism.
Well, that is the nationalism that I experienced over 6 years in China was extraordinary. I had heard that it was a powerful force, but living in China, you quickly understand that how much it's inculcated in Chinese, this sense of aggrievement over what the textbooks, the Chinese textbooks, call the century of humiliation. I was there in a period where there was strong anti-Japanese feeling, to the point where I had never lived in a society where there was that much what I would call hatred towards another ethnicity and country, to the point where I once went on a reporting trip to Zhejiang province on the coast with my research assistant. We stopped in at the home of her boyfriend's family. And there was a three-year-old boy in the room, and he had never seen a foreigner before, but he looked at me and said in Chinese, "Are you Japanese?" And I said, "No, I'm not Japanese." And he said, "That's good, because I hate Japanese." And I was stunned. A three-year-old boy, he could have only heard that from his parents. So, you know, this sort of nationalist feeling is something that I feel stoked. It's fomented by policies that are instituted by the party.
And Tim Johnson, in terms of the Han Chinese settlement of Tibet, which has followed the introduction of this $4.1 billion SkyTrain that the Chinese built up there, I take it that this is a kind of campaign of cultural annihilation.
Well, certainly the Chinese, the ruling party would dispute that greatly, but Let me tell you that I believe it's true. Under Mao Zedong, since the 1949 revolution, the party has attempted to quell any possibility of minority unrest through a variety of techniques. And one of those techniques is build a railway. Secondly, it is funnel in investment and lift standards of living. Thirdly, it's quell religious expression. And this has been aimed not only at Tibet, but also the Xinjiang Uyghur autonomous region in the far west and northwest.
And the Falun Gong.
Yes, and the Falun Gong, although it's not an ethnic group.
You said religious.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, if that is a religion, they sure as hell went down.
Absolutely. It was declared an evil sect and crushed within a matter of a year or two, really. So the train, the Sky Train, has allowed, some people would even say pushed, but allowed Han to migrate very easily, willingly to Tibet, even as they have problems migrating to other cities. You ask about population figures in Tibet, and it's almost considered like a state secret. But generally, the people I talk to estimate that two-thirds of Lhasa, the capital of Tibet, is now non-Tibetan. And if you'll just forbear with me for a second, Xinjiang is very interesting with the Uyghurs. And it's like a step ahead because in 1949, the Han population of what is now Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region was about 6%, 1949. Now it's 40%. So there you go. If that's not a force for cultural dilution, what is?
Again, I'm speaking with Tim Johnson, the author of Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World but Lost the Battle with China. And let's go back in history then, as your book does, to the loss of Tibet. Its greatest defense was its geography. It's 15,000 feet plateau, way in the middle of nowhere. And my understanding is that, let me specifically ask you, what was the Chinese strategic motive here? I understand they were concerned about, they wanted not so much confront India, but at least let India know that they were the other big guy in the neighborhood. There was a strategic vacuum in there, which I believe the CIA exploited to some extent, using Tibetans to harass Chinese outer settlements. I don't know whether that was a tactic or a strategy on our part to take pressure off Taiwan and other things, creating a kind of long logistical train for the Chinese all the way up there. But the long and the short of it is, let's dispense with a couple of things. Did the United States in any way create a kind of blowback? Did they in any way entice the Chinese to occupy this strategic vacuum?
I don't think so. I didn't spend a lot of my research on that particular period of history, but I think there are other more compelling reasons for China to move in. First of all, as a modern nation state, in a multi-ethnic one, while Han predominate, they're 92% of the population, the 8% of the minorities, many of them populate the periphery of the state. And having the claim on Taiwan, which is self-governed, it was very important for the party to not have any restive populations on the periphery for fear that the country could be dismembered. And as you said, Tibet is a very important buffer with a traditional rival. Tibet is strategically important for other reasons. It's the head. Tibet is called the third pole after the North and South Pole because of the water frozen in the glaciers there. Headwaters are the seven mightiest rivers in Asia. The relationship with India, of course, there's ongoing border disputes that are really significant. China claims Arunachal Pradesh in the eastern portion, and there's a part of the western portion that's occupied by India. And so there are these ongoing tensions. Curiously, trade is booming. It's gone, two-way trade has gone from about $13.5 billion in 2004 to about $60 billion at the present. And the goal—
Are you talking about trade between China and India?
China and India. So that economic relationship is what social scientists might call a hot relationship. The diplomacy is a cold relationship, but it's getting ever hotter. It's they're talking about trade reaching $100 billion by 2015. So it's a complicated relationship.
But there is, of course, this relationship that China has, the geostrategic and military relationship with Pakistan, who also share that very narrow border up there in the Himalayas. And we've recently learned now that Pakistan has perhaps passed the United Kingdom and France as a nuclear power. There's an impoverished country that's got more nuclear weapons than France and England, largely because the Chinese have been giving them these reactors and they gave them the designs for the bombs in the first place. What in God's name are the Chinese thinking? You know?
I can't answer that, but I can say that that relationship makes the Indians very uneasy. And it's not just Pakistan. It's interesting to look at what's happening in Nepal as well, because Nepal is quickly becoming ever more a client state of China. I went to Kathmandu and into the valley on the Nepalese side of Mount Everest to await Tibetan refugees coming over the Himalayas. And it was clear that Nepalese border police are, you know, acting at the behest of the Chinese and trying to capture these people as well. So the Nepalese government is listening very carefully to any cues that come from Beijing.
So when China first invaded Tibet, I believe that the Tibetans didn't put up any resistance. I don't know whether there was a division within the Tibetan government there, and the Dalai Lama was relatively young at that point, I think. But they didn't. It was defensible for some reason. I guess they were being Buddhist. Did they just decide to turn the other cheek?
Well, they're
obviously they're up against a powerful.
Remember that they're Buddhist, but also there is a tradition in Tibet that the monasteries would have what they called soldier monks, and so there were conflicts between monasteries over a variety of issues, and at times there were quarrels that would have some violence. I think it would be wrong to paint Tibetans as uniformly pacifist. And at the time the PLA, the Red Army, began its march into Tibet in 1950, there was some resistance. But, of course, they didn't have many arms, very old, rifles and so forth. And they were easily quashed by a much better disciplined and trained and numerous force.
And then there was that period of occupation while the Dalai Lama and the Tibetans tried to make an accommodation. And then it reached a point where the Dalai Lama had to flee.
Well, it was a very tense period in the run-up to that date in March 1959 in which Chinese soldiers were there on the Lhasa Plain in large numbers. And one of the Chinese military leaders sent word to invite the Dalai Lama and a small retinue without any protection or bodyguards to come see a theatrical performance. And the Dalai Lama, of course, being only at that point about 24 years old and not particularly experienced, was advised that, this was a ruse, that if he went, they might capture him and take him away somewhere. And so that was when the decision was made that it was an untenable situation. He had to flee the country.
Well, would they have captured him?
That's one of the great mysteries, whether that was the intent or not. Of course, the Chinese say, no, it was simply a theatrical performance. Uh-huh. One of the interesting things about that era is that, there's actually a grain of truth in some of what the Chinese government says about Tibet. The social situation was not great. So there was, when they say that, the Chinese say that Tibet was in a state of serfdom.
Feudal.
Mm-hmm. There was some truth to that. And I've talked to Tibetans. In fact, I mentioned it in an early chapter of the book that there were Tibetans who sided with the party. And one of the most famous and well-known, the first Tibetan party member, is now under virtual house arrest because he's It's not house arrest, but he's not allowed to speak out because he's in a series of letters, has made plain that he thinks it's a tactical error by the party not to engage in real negotiations with the Dalai Lama. He says that the Dalai Lama's position, the so-called middle way that's about 20 years old, this policy that says, yes, we Tibetans can live under Chinese rule as long as we have greater autonomy. The secret about this is that that's not a popular position with Tibetans. But because they're Buddhists and devoted to the Dalai Lama and venerate him, they don't articulate it opposition in a way that we would see as real opposition. It's whatever His Holiness wants. But if you talk with them individually, it's very clear, especially among exiles, that were he not there, yes, they want independence. At least probably a majority of the people I talked with certainly do. And so that's the real danger and tragedy in the future, is that because the Chinese party won't negotiate seriously with the Dalai Lama and believes that when he passes away, somehow the problem will be resolved. In fact, it may worsen because there'll be a sense of desperation.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Tim Johnson, the author of Tragedy in Crimson, book about the Dalai Lama and the tragedy of Tibet, the subtitle of which is How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World but Lost the Battle with China, and lost being the operative word. And of course, if the Communist Party of the People's Republic of China get their way and are able to essentially choose the Dalai Lama's successor in what has been referred to by in wonderful communist language, guidelines on reincarnation. Mm-hmm. I mean, will they get away with it? I mean, do you think that they'll not just physically subdue these people, but spiritually conquer them?
Well, I think we have to look back at what they've done in the past. In 1989, 5 months or so before the Tiananmen Square uprising, the number two Tibetan Buddhist, the most senior Lama, the Panchen Lama, died. And this was, you know, usually the Panchen Lama and the Dalai Lama are of offsetting ages. So when one dies, the other helps in the process of selecting, finding a reincarnation. Well, several years later, there was a young lad found, and the Dalai Lama concurred with other senior lamas that this was a reincarnation of the Panchen Lama. As soon as word got out that that was the case, the boy disappeared from the Tibetan plateau. He was taken by Chinese security forces, and this was seen as an untenable position to have a Panchen Lama that would have been approved by the Dalai Lama. The Tibetan government in exile, the Dalai Lama himself, has called this young lad, whose whereabouts are unknown to this day, the world's youngest political prisoner. Now, ironically, he's no longer so young. He's probably about 21, or he's in his, in his
20s. That's assuming he's alive, right?
Well, that's assuming he's alive, because no one knows. There's only these statements from the state news agency in which they say that he's living a happy life with access to education with his family and chooses not to be in the public eye. So the Chinese then named their own Panchen Lama reincarnate. And I was at a World Buddhist Forum that was, curiously, arranged by the party in Hangzhou a few years ago, in which this now a young man, I guess he was probably 17 or so at the time, made an appearance, and it was a real pro forma appearance. But more recently, he's been studying English. I think it was last year that he went to the same conference and spoke some in English. What's obvious to anybody who hears him is that he is, his public positions are for love of the motherland as much as they are for Buddhism. So he's a good spokesman for the party.
Well, just in closing, Tim Johnson, since we're offering your book up here today, Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World but Lost the Battle with China, in support of this program, and we're grateful that you could drop by the studio, what Give us a sense, though, for our audience, why you embarked on this project, why this is an important story. We began talking about the echoes of nonviolence and Buddhism in what's going on in the world today with these revolutions in the Middle East. But in a sense, to go beyond the Free Tibet bumper sticker and give us an explanation for why you think this is an important story.
Well, let me start with a little bit of my own history. When I first went abroad as a correspondent, it was in 1984, and I was given a small fellowship, and I was studying and reporting in Chile under the Pinochet government, and it made a huge impression on me. I was there a year and a half, and to see the whole state security apparatus and how it sought to how it dealt with anybody in the political opposition, including several cases that were just chilling in terms of the repression. A case of what they called the Tres Degollados, these school teachers who were found with their throats slit and so forth. I confess, it made a big impression on me. I later in my reporting career had to travel quite a bit to Cuba, and I did so as a Miami Herald correspondent. There I saw that the other hand of this, a government of the left that was also using state security apparatus in a repressive way, I felt. So when I arrived in China, I had that within me, the experience of both the left and the right. And I took my first trip to Tibet in 2007, and I was dismayed and rather stunned at the level of repression that I saw in Tibet. And that's why I chose to write about it, because we had some run-ins ourselves. I was with a German reporter and a Mexican photographer, and we were chased around and kept under extremely tight guidance and minders and so forth. And we saw the closed-circuit TV cameras all over Lhasa and talked to people in monasteries that were saying, we're afraid to even whisper at us. So... And as I looked into it more, and after the 2008 uprisings, I realized the situation was getting worse and worse. And so I felt really moved by it personally. And as I did research on it, I pondered pretty deeply about why this matters, because there's only 5.5 million Tibetans. But I think the key issue is that this issue, this how China treats the Tibetans is emblematic of how it treats a number of groups that are weaker and potentially in opposition to the ruling party, and not only other groups, other countries. And we've seen the tensions escalate with Japan and Vietnam. So today, the Tibetans. Tomorrow, who will it be? Will it be Vietnam? Or, in the future, as China rises, of course, it could be us.
Well, that was a question I was about to ask, which is, if China becomes the global hegemon and they're supposed to pass the U.S. economy in 2027, if this is how they treat their own people, they consider subjects within their own borders, let's hold our breath and wait to see how they treat the rest of the world.
Well, it part of why it's important to see how they treat the Tibetans is because the Chinese, the Han Chinese, and I don't even want to say Han Chinese, I want to say the Communist Party style, because I don't think Chinese are necessarily that opposed to what the Tibetans may want. The party has a give no inch style. Mm-hmm. And so if they enter negotiations, it's basically to negotiate the other party's surrender. In the case of the Dalai Lama, it's to basically have him agree to come live in Beijing, never set foot in Tibet, and probably live under virtual house arrest in Beijing. That's what they're willing to negotiate, nothing else.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and Tim Johnson, and for your book, Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World But Lost the Battle with China.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And again, I was speaking with Tim Johnson, who's the author of this new book, Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World But Lost the Battle with China. Between 2003 and 2009, Tim Johnson was the Beijing bureau chief for Knight Ridder and McClatchy, with responsibility for China and Taiwan. He previously worked for 14 years for the Miami Herald, covering U.S. policy towards Latin America. He served as a foreign correspondent for the Herald through most of the 1990s in Central America and the Andean region, and he's currently the Mexico City bureau chief for McClatchy Newspapers.